Hey, everybody, and welcome to Movie Crush. Charles W. Chuck Bryant here at our home studio at Pond City Market, Atlanta, Georgia, along with the sunny and bright and well-coiffed Noel.
Thank you for commenting on my coiffery, Chuck. I appreciate that. I've been working on it.
Well, Noel and I both have these big dumb beards like all guys have. I can't wait for the day we look back at pictures and everyone goes, what the fuck were we all doing?
Well, apparently beards are out, Chuck, but I've never worn my beard for fashion. It is just strictly to hide my double chin.
Oh, yes. I have quite a few chins under here as well, and it does a great job. But Noel used to have big shaggy hair, too, but then you got it cut, what, 6 months ago or so?
Well, I got a promotion at work, Chuck, and I had to the do had to match the resume. So,
they say dress for the job you want. In this case, it's cut your hair for the job you got.
Exactly.
Sort of reverse. And Alex just cut his hair. It looks very nice.
He did. He's getting married soon. That might be why.
Oh, okay. So that was his lovely bride-to-be at the Christmas party.
Yes, she's delightful.
You're like, no, that was someone else.
Alex is another guy we work with, a producer who did the music for my other podcast, Ridiculous History, which we get comments on all the time. He's another jack-of-all-trades, How Stuff Works super producer.
Yeah, man, he's great, and Tristan is great. We have such an amazing team. Did all these guys come through you?
They did.
Man. You can find them.
Very lucky to be able to give amazing people an amazing opportunity here.
Well, and it's cool because all of these editors and engineers, like you said, jack of all trades, it's like they're all musicians and I assume originally probably video and film editors.
Yep.
Yeah. It's great. And Alex, by the way, is one of the lead hands on Atlanta Monster, which is our partnership with Tenderfoot TV and True Crime Show about the Atlanta child murders. That has blown up the podcasting world.
It's true. Setting the charts on fire.
Yeah, I'm a fan, actually. I've been listening every week because I grew up during the Atlanta child murders. And even as a white suburban kid in Atlanta, it was scary at the time.
You talked about that a good bit with your buddy Dave Willis, who also grew up in the area, and about sort of was a specter hanging over, like parents didn't want you to go to the mall by yourself.
Oh, yeah, man. It was a real thing. So, welcome everyone. As you know, follow us on Facebook so you can interact with the show where we post questions and we call emails. And, we have a few segments that we're going to do today. And number one, we'll go ahead and get right into it, called Grip This. Yeah! It's a new one.
I like it.
So the idea here is that, occasionally I will, explain something about the film industry and these weird, names. And job titles that you see on the movie screen in front of you, because I take it for granted because I worked in the film industry that everyone knows what a dolly grip is and what a Foley artist is, and what a gaffer is. But, a lot of people don't know this stuff, and we get emails from time to time saying, hey, you guys, you and Josh on Stuff You Should Know should do a podcast just explaining, what these jobs are in film crews. So I'm going to do that here. In this segment of Grip This, I'm going to talk about, the job of producer. And this is a weird, weird job in the movie industry because a producer can be everything from, strictly the financier of your project all the way down to, and in that case, it would be an executive producer, almost assuredly, all the way down to an associate producer who, might just be someone who did you a favor. That allowed you to shoot one scene for a movie. And so in lieu of money, they might say, all right, we'll give you an associate producer credit. And sometimes that works, believe it or not. So we're going to go through a few of these various titles. Executive producer obviously is at the top. And like I said, they could be the financier of the movie. They can be the head of the studio that you are working with, like a Steven Spielberg, let's say. And as an executive producer in that case, it can run the gamut from someone who just says, I allow you to go make this movie with our studio, to maybe they will even oversee parts of it and weigh in creatively at times or help make connections to, actors or writers or pull the crew together as a director and maybe package it. It really, there is no set script for what an executive producer might do that could be super involved or not very involved.
And you see stars in TV shows get elevated to executive producer as they earn more cachet in
Absolutely.
The show, like The Office. A lot of the main players at later seasons, you see them with executive producer credits.
Yeah, that's a true up the ladder type of thing. And actually, when Josh and I did our silly little TV show for Science Channel, one of the things that we negotiated was producer credit. Mm-hmm. I don't even know why, just a little feather in the cap. Although we did do the job of producer. I mean, we were involved soup to nuts in that show. So executive producer, again, might represent the studio. They might keep watch over it, or maybe it's just symbolic, to give the movie visibility. For instance, George Clooney was an executive producer of the great, great movie Far From Heaven. But he wasn't really on the set, making decisions. But he did have something to do with it early on. So sometimes that will just give it a little cachet. Associate producer, like I said, well, let's go just with the regular producer title. This can be a lot of things because you can see a lot of producers listed on a movie. But when I think of producer with just that title, I think of the main person who is working on this movie from beginning to end, hand in hand with the director. Packaging the movie, working with the crew, casting, helping with casting, really just sort of the partner of the director going into battle together to get this movie made. Since we're on Far From Heaven, the great Christine Vachon was a producer of that, and she's one of the all-time great producers, has a stellar, stellar list of credits to her name. And Christine Vachon is a feet to the ground, get down to it, nitty gritty producer involved in every aspect of the making of the movie from the very beginning to the very end. But producer can also mean you're just, you know, sort of involved, or maybe one of the actors. Assistant producer, they basically work on things that, the producers tell you to do. So it's just sort of almost like a co-producer, but then there's also a credit of co-producer. And they share responsibilities generally as a group and as a team of producers, maybe take on some creative responsibilities. Another co-producer might handle more of the business. But then you also have the line producer. And the line producer generally is handling the budgetary things, the physical aspects of the movie production, not as involved creatively, but they're really there day-to-day, making sure that everything is, all departments have what they need, and have the money they need, or in some cases they don't have the money and they have to figure out how to do it anyway. So that's the line producer. The associate producer, like I said, can be involved. Or it can be, like I said, like a title that you just throw out to someone who did you a little favor. It's like a courtesy title sometimes as a backer of the film. They may not play a major role at all, but sometimes they have worked on the movie. It's a very nebulous sort of gray area for a lot of these titles. I think you're starting to get that picture. Supervising producer, they can oversee some of the other producers as they perform some of their duties. Sometimes they may take the place of an executive producer or work for the executive producer. And then you have finally the coordinating producer, and they coordinate the work of several producers. Is it starting to get that thing where you say the producer word so many times?
Yeah.
It starts to sound funny.
Producer overload.
Yeah. Recording producers they're very valuable if a studio is producing related films. And the example here on How Stuff Works is the movie Spider-Man. When you have two related films being produced at the same time, like the Pirates of the Caribbean or the Spider-Man movies, or like when they did Lord of the Rings all together, sometimes a coordinating producer might make sure all the various heads are talking to one another.
Well, yeah, especially if there's like Marvel Cinematic Universe type stuff.
Sure.
Where there has to be continuity from one movie to the yep. next, and they have to know what the other crew is doing in order for the one crew to do it right, you know? So
absolutely. Yeah. So that is Grip This for this week. And
but what's the best boy, Chuck?
Oh, well, we'll get to that.
All right.
So hopefully that cleared things up, but I have a feeling I've just really confused everyone further on what a producer is.
I once met this guy, Dean Zanuck, who's the son of famed producer Richard Zanuck.
Who also was related Jaws to Daryl Zanuck, I think.
Yeah, and Dean was producing this movie, Get Low, that had Bill Murray in it.
Yeah, I remember that movie.
It was good, but they shot it near my hometown of Augusta, uh-huh, Georgia, and I did a piece on it for public radio, and I got to go to the set. They shot it in a town called Crawfordville, uh-huh, and I kind of asked Dean what a producer was, or how do you become a producer?
Right.
And there was no real clear answer.
That's an adorable question from you at
exactly,
that age, too.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he was sort of like, you know, the ultimate answer was you're the son of Richard Zanuck.
Yeah, it is getting into the job of producer is kind of weird. And like Emily, my wife was a producer. She produced music videos. And in that case, the path to producer is you usually start work as a PA and then you move up to maybe production coordinator. Mm-hmm. And then you move up to production manager, mm-hmm, or maybe UPM, unit production manager, and eventually you can get work as a producer.
And then the line producer is sort of attainable too. Isn't that a little bit more of a functional job kind of?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's like you're handling the money and the budget, mm-hmm, and those, you know, like Emily's a producer, unfortunately wasn't super involved creatively. They are the people responsible for pulling off that job.
Got it.
And in the case of music videos, that is a tough, tough job. Or at least was back then. I don't even know if they still make music videos. Do
people
they
just all make them with their phones now?
Okay, good. All right. Segment two. We're going to move on to another edition of the highlight reel. This week, I'm going to highlight the wonderful, the amazing, the lovely and amazing, hint, hint, Nicole Holofcener. In her first three films specifically. Nicole Holofcener is one of my filmmaking heroes. She is from New York City and began her career as a writer and director in 1996 with the independent film Walking and Talking, with a very young Catherine Keener and Liev Schreiber and Hesh, Todd Field, and Kevin Corrigan. And it was in that, I know I talk about it all the time, but that wonderful mid-90s period where independent film was burgeoning and really kind of put itself on the map. And there were so many great, great movies made then. And Walking and Talking is certainly one of them. The story of these two best friends, Catherine Keener and Hesh, or Hesh. Is it Hesh?
I think it's Hesh, yeah.
And Hesh. I haven't seen her in a while. She's good. Or she can be.
Yeah, it seemed like she kind of disappeared.
Yeah. Let's go find Anne Hesh, sure, and put her on the show. I'm sure that'll do it. That'll put her right back on the star map.
Wasn't she married to Ellen for a while, or weren't they like an item?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
I remember that.
So they play good friends, and Liev Schreiber is the friend of Catherine Keener, and just sort of their life in New York as 20-somethings and failed love affairs and romances. It's just a really, really great movie. 5 years later, it took 5 years, I imagine, because Nicole Holofcener is a woman in Hollywood in the mid-90s. And there just was not and still is not enough opportunity for female writers and directors. So it took her 5 years after the great Walking and Talking to make Lovely and Amazing, which is a wonderful film with, again, Catherine Keener. As you will see, she's become a staple in her movies. The great Brenda Bleven, Emily Mortimer, and the first movie from a young woman or a young girl at the time, I guess, Raven Goodwin. And it's a story of a mom and two daughters and a granddaughter and their life together, and it's just, again, so sweet and so real, and which is sort of a pattern you will see in Nicole Holofcener's work. She just is able to tap into these real human emotions and get these great performances out of all her actors. And then finally, movie number three, Friends with Money. Jennifer Aniston, and it's when Jennifer Aniston left Friends and took the – or when Friends ended, and she took that turn in her career where she wanted to do some – smaller movies, some more independent films, and did some really good quality movies during that period. And Friends with Money was certainly one of them. And it is the story of four sisters, Jennifer Aniston, Joan Cusack, the wonderfully amazing Frances McDormand, and again, Catherine Keener, one of my favorite actors. And they are four sisters, and it's about, again, just their interpersonal relationships, and, some are married, some are not. Some are looking for love, like Jennifer Aniston's character, and money. It's called Friends with Money because that is a theme of the movie. There's sort of an undercurrent of of, and you don't see this in movies, which is what made this so real, is, and it's a real thing. It's like, if some people have more money than others in a friend group, it can get weird. And, that's the case here. And it's just sort of a real life thing that you never see in movies. And in this case, Frances McDormand has made a lot of money as a fashion designer. Whereas Jennifer Aniston is, and I think Catherine Keener's character and her husband are also very well off in Los Angeles. And Jennifer Aniston has not much money, and she's cleaning houses, to get by. And as the sister, you know, they try to do everything they can to help her out, but it's just a really interesting look at what money means when it comes to relationships with one another. But it's done in a very real way. It's not like they don't, you know, she doesn't beat you over the head, with finance. If that makes sense.
I thought Bridesmaids did an interesting job of that as well. And their friend.
For
group.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause that's the deal. You know, that's a thing. Like if a group of friends, if someone breaks out and has a lot of dough all of a sudden, it can make things really weird and uncomfortable. There can be jealousies involved for sure. And in this movie, the ones with the money are very generous, but then Jennifer Aniston also doesn't want to take them up on that generosity. Whereas the people with the dough are kind of like, hey, it doesn't matter to me. But to be in that position where money doesn't matter is very unique and uncomfortable when your sister or brother or friend does not have the money. So it's really interesting. It's called Friends with Money. And also just a quick shout out to the movies that followed are also great. One called Please Give, again with Catherine Keener and the great, great Oliver Platt and Amanda Peet. And then she did the last movie with James Gandolfini before he passed away, called Enough Said with Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
She has some great TV credits too, like 6 Feet Under.
Oh,
she
yes.
did a few episodes, and I want to say she did some Parks and Rec and uh-huh. Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt
yep.
and Enlightened, which I think is a little bit of an underappreciated show with Laura Dern.
That was one of my favorite shows. Mm. In fact, you know, I'm going to save that one for the highlight reel. Enlightened was so great.
Awesome.
And also, she directed, Nicole Holofcener directed the pilot for One Mississippi, the great, great show that I'm about to talk about right now on Stream This. All right. As we finish up with Stream This and Comment Card, as I mentioned, One Mississippi season 2 is what I'm going to highlight this week. The wonderful Tig Notaro, who was, in episode 2 of Movie Crush. And if you haven't listened to that one, the numbers are a little lower for that one because it was very early on. But if you haven't, go back and listen to the Tig Notaro episode, because the setup for that very quickly is she came in here, and right before we recorded and hit record, she got the call that she was cancer-free, the call that she had been waiting on from her doctor. And as any fan of Tig knows, she's been through the ringer with her health and her life. And she is laid bare all up on stage, quite literally, actually. And has been very upfront about her battle with cancer and her struggle. So I come in to record. She's literally crying in the studio, and no one knows what's going on. And as it turns out, that was there were tears of joy because she'd gotten the cancer-free call. And we launched right into recording about the movie Mask. So it's a show I'm super proud of. So if you haven't listened to that, go back. But Tig's show, One Mississippi, is just great. It's a story of her going back to her hometown in Mississippi after her mother has passed. Again, autobiographical. And season 2 really makes great strides with her relationship with a local woman there working at the radio station who is her real-life wife, Stephanie. And they are just have obviously chemistry off-screen, so they have it on-screen as well. And Stephanie's just adorably wonderful on that show. And I just saw her in a Super Bowl commercial too, which is kind of funny. I was like, wait, there's Stephanie. Good for her making some big dough. And she, you know, continues to bond with her brother character on the show and come to terms with her mother's widowed husband, which is a problematic and strange relationship. So One Mississippi season 2 just continued to build on the great foundation they laid in season 1. And if you haven't seen it on Amazon, you can stream it now. And very sadly, I just found out that it was not renewed. So that's all we're going to get of One Mississippi.
Oh, man.
Which really bumps me out.
Do you think it's the Louis backlash?
No, I don't think so. I think it just didn't get renewed.
Yeah.
Smallish audience from what Tig said.
I can see that.
Very loyal audience, though.
Yeah.
She has very loyal fans. myself included. And here's kind of a cool thing, dude. I was, I saw her post on Facebook that she, there's a club in LA called Largo. Do you know Largo?
Of course. Yeah.
And Josh and I performed at Largo. It's right there in Hollywood and it's known for just, some of the best, comedy shows and, they curate just some of the best shows in town. And Largo, she had a picture of her sitting on the couch there, backstage. And she said, when my mother passed away, I had all of her furniture and stuff and I didn't know what to do with this couch. I had no room for it. So I called, can't remember the owner and proprietor of Largo, but she said, I called him up and he said, hey, you can keep it here. So she had her picture taken on that couch, which was her dearly departed mother's couch. And I saw that and I was like, man, I have sat on that couch and I had no idea that it was Tig's mom's couch. So it was just very cool. If you love Tig and then you definitely love her story of her and her mother's relationship. So it was just kind of neat for me to be like, wait a minute. I've been on Tig's mom's couch.
Well, Largo was the spot where she recorded all those specials, I think.
Yeah.
Like early on.
For sure.
That became the stuff that she was known for on This American Life and all that.
Absolutely.
Telling her story.
Yeah. Largo's great.
I have never been. I really like to.
It's cool. Well, you go to LA a lot now, so.
John Bryan, you know John Bryan, the film composer?
Yes.
He does like a monthly gig there. I've always heard that it's amazing. I'd really like to go see him do that.
Yeah.
He did a lot of P.T. Anderson music and produced the Good Fiona Apple records.
Yep.
And
he's in that crowd, the Largo crowd is what I call it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is well, it's not new now, but this is the second location for Largo. When I lived in L.A., it was a even smaller venue in Hollywood where I – saw Rufus Wainwright play very early on. It was almost like a piano bar. It was very cool. It was one of the first dates I went on with Emily.
They call it Largo at the Coronet now, I think. Is that the differentiation there?
Yeah, because it's the old Coronet Theater.
I got it.
One of the old great Hollywood theaters.
Cool.
So, One Mississippi Season 2. Stream it on Amazon. Support Tig Notaro and all her efforts because she is the best. Finally, we'll finish up with comment card. I got a couple of emails here that I call from Facebook. This is from Vanessa Lopez. Hi, Chuckers and Noel. Noel, you're officially a cast member.
That's so cool, man.
Isn't that great?
Appreciate it.
I've listened to Stuff You Should Know for years, and I'm loving Movie Crush. It's fun hearing the conversations about how much these movies mean to each of your guests. People always say the book is better than the movie. Is there a movie that comes to mind that you think was actually better than the book? For me, it's Misery. Not even Stephen King could write a character creepier than Kathy Bates played. Good one.
It is a good one.
So this one was hard for me because I haven't read a ton of books that later became adapted into films. But of the ones I have read, I can't say that they were better, but I will say they were as good as I could have hoped, mainly because I read good books. I went to look online just to see – get some inspiration. And typically, like, the list is like The Godfather and Jaws and these things that were kind of popcorn summer books that were made into really great movies. But I read really good books to begin with. So it's kind of hard to say, well, No Country for Old Men, because that was a great, great book and a great, great movie.
Yeah, I think it's all about the way it handles the source material. And sometimes if it like can paint this picture visually that is so arresting, then it's almost like you can say this medium told the story better in a way.
Right. Well, I mean, if they managed to bring it to life in a way and cast it, casting is so important because when you read a book, or at least I do, I almost always cast it in my brain from like Hollywood, you know, actors.
Yeah.
I usually don't read a book and just think of just some random, you know, face.
I think in some ways the Game of Thrones TV show is better than the books because the books get mired down in a lot of these real flowery, overly long descriptions of like tables of food and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And where in the book it's like you can describe a banquet table in 5 pages. In the movie or in the TV show, you just
see
the camera pans over it and you're done with the food, you know?
So. Yeah. That's always really interesting for me to see that happen. Like the thing in the book that is so well described that could just be a shot or not even in the movie at all. So for me, as a tie, I'm going to go with No Country for Old Men. I'm going to go with The Virgin Suicides, the great book and movie, the book from Jeffrey Eugenides and the movie from Sofia Coppola. Great, great adaptation. There's a book and movie called Jesus's Son with Billy Crudup, a little independent film. Really, really great book of almost little independent short stories. And the director, Allison McLean, managed to tie and weave these stories together in a great way in the movie that it was one of those when you read the book, I thought it would be pretty challenging. And Jesus' Son from 1999, really, really good movie. And also, I mean, one of the great casts, I don't know how she got such a cast for an independent movie, but it has not only Billy Crudup, Samantha Morton, Holly Hunter, Dennis Hopper, Dennis Leary, Michael Shannon, a young Michael Shannon before That's anyone right. knew him.
Yeah.
Jack Black is in the movie.
Yeah.
It's just got
He's the orderly.
Well, I won't ruin that.
No. That's a movie that's like every – like it's like equal parts heartbreaking and hilarious and like full of joy. And it just kind of runs the gamut, but not in like a way that's like overly kind of overwrought, you know? It's really, really good.
Agreed. So. Wonderful movie. And then To Kill a Mockingbird, to go back in time a bit. Great book. Great movie. And then finally, American Psycho. I read American Psycho in college when it came out. And – this is a weird one in that I was terrified reading this book. And then when the movie came out as a dark comedy, I had to completely rethink the eyes through which I had read it. Mm-hmm. Did you see or read?
I didn't finish that book because it was just, it was like so horrific and misogynistic. And it was just, I almost was like, what if someone reads this over my shoulder that I'm reading right now? They're going to think I'm like the sickest human being alive.
Yeah.
And the movie doesn't have, like in the book, it's just so graphic that it's just like you can't even imagine. And the movie really pares it down and plays up the dark comedy aspect. And I like that movie a lot. I haven't seen it in years. I wonder if it holds up.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, again, I never thought of it as a dark comedy at all. And it's one that really made me go back and rethink everything. Mm. But I guess it is a dark comedy.
Female director as well.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's about the only way you could make that movie. You know, because it is brutally misogynistic and awful about a serial killer who preys on women. Well, he preys on men too, but yeah, pretty bad stuff. And somehow managed to wreak some comedy out of it.
And that's Mary Harron.
That's Mary Harron who, yeah, off mic, I thought Mary Harron had directed Jesus' Son. Getting all the ducks in a row, everyone. So that is it for this week. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks to Noel, as always, for the insight. And this week we have, oh boy, everybody, hold on to your hats. I went to New York City and I got into a studio with the great Tony Shalhoub.
The Tony Shalhoub?
Well, he certainly looked like him.
That's exciting, Chuck. I can't wait to hear that one.
Yeah, it was Tony Shalhoub and we talked about The Sting, so... I know Tony through a friend from high school, and he hooked this up, and Tony was awesome and a big thrill. Like, he's a legit, like, I almost want to say legend of TV and film. Guy's been around forever and been in a million things.
I think legend is utterly a fair characterization.
All right. So Tony has talked about The Sting, which is a great movie, and this is now marks the second Newman and Redford directed by George Roy Hill pick after Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And Tony loved The Sting, and so did I, and it was a really great interview. So, brush up to crush out this week, and thanks for joining us. Right, Noel?
Yeah, man. It's always a pleasure.
All right, we'll see you guys next week.